although maybe some of the fuel is no longer required because you're starting off at a much higher altitude, and an awful lot of the weight in the beginning is the fuel that you're taking up with you. So what kind of spacecraft do you envision being launched this way? Some of the spacecraft on the launch pad are 200 and 300 feet tall, and I'm getting the impression that the strato launcher is not going to take something that large. So what's the anticipated way of using this ball, and how big a payload is going to go where? Is this going to be a low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit? I'm having trouble believing it's going to be a geosynchronous orbit craft launched in this manner. WS2N, T2LAW.
Oh, I don't know. If it was going to be geosynchronous, it was probably very light, I would think. But it's a Pegasus rocket. I don't think Pegasus has ever launched anything in geosynchronous orbit, but they go, they go 400 or 500 miles. Pegasus is, I have to look the weight up, but it's only maybe 60 feet long or so. It's not all that big. Yeah, it doesn't look like a first stage or of a rocket. Maybe it looks like a second stage. total weight, they say it's 500,000 pounds empty. Then you load it up with fuel plus a payload. It's going to take off from the ground with 1.5 million pounds total lift. That's what's going to be, 1.5 million pounds. So that's a lot of weight. And, it's going to take me a couple of minutes. I could look up the weight of the Pegasus rocket. That would give you an idea. That's in existence now. They've launched 42 or 43 of these things. So, like the next launch is out in, I think, Spain. Going to launch one. Another one, Kwajalein Island, I think, is scheduled for this year. On the Marshall Islands. Back to you, Dick. And that's about all I got on the strato launch. Back to you.
So strato launch is going to lift up Pegasus. Pegasus has launched how heavy a payload and how high in the past, Paul?
Repeater, time out.
You've got a Paul.
Okay, the Cygnus spacecraft, there was, I think, 8 of them. Or, I have to check. There were 8. And they were all successful, and they launched at the same time. And each one was, let's say each one was 1,000 pounds, probably 8,000 pounds, something like that. Maybe a little lighter. So, whatever the Pegasus could launch, that's it. The neutron star, new star, I think they call it. Don't know the weight of that. I know when it was unfurled, it was like 30 feet long in space. It does pretty good sized payloads. But again, I'll have to check the numbers. But, launched by Orbital ATK. They're the ones that launch Pegasus. So if you look up Orbital ATK Pegasus, they'll tell you everything about it, the payload, how much the payload could be, the low Earth orbit. I can find all that out. And the good thing about strato launch, but if you want to launch a polar orbit, we can do that. You want to go down right off the equator, we can do that too. They can launch anywhere. Back to you.
What is the stated advantage of strato launch? It's going to take your normally launched from the ground spacecraft and bring it up to 40, 50, 60,000 feet and then launch it. That doesn't strike me as a big enough altitude that you no longer need the first stage. It sure would be nice, though, if the strato launcher would bypass the requirement for the first stage. So what is the stated benefit of using straddle launcher pole? WS2N, K2LAW.
I would say launching, you know, a couple thousand pound satellites to low Earth orbit. If you're going to start in with a geosynchronous orbit or, you know, heavy modules to the International Space Station, yeah, it's not going to do it, but there's so many satellites that they want to put up, that they do put up, that are relatively lightweight, you know, a couple of thousand pounds, 3,000, 4,000 pounds, you can put it into low Earth orbit at a fraction of the cost. And you can say to Paul Allen, who owns this straddle launcher, you know, I want to fly, you know, first month of next year, and they can sign you up, and you know pretty much off you're going to go. Right now, if you have a smaller satellite, you might have to take a ride on, you know, secondary ride on a Falcon 9 rocket, you know, or sign up with Ariane and take a, you know, take a backseat to that, become a second, you know, second satellite or a third satellite on board, and so it's probably cost, it's economic, at least I expect it to be.
Yeah, the YouTube video that I've seen on Straddle Launcher sounded like the majority of the flight tests are not going to be until next year. So Straddle Launcher being fully operational, that sounds like it's at least 2 years downrange. Is that true, Paul?
Oh, yeah, I agree. We'll see. I mean, you know, you got smaller satellites that, you know, that take a ride all the time. For instance, the Dragon that just went up yesterday. By the way, the booster was recovered, and the booster came back down and landed at Cape Canaveral. So that's the 11th time they've saved the booster, bringing the cost down, and the spacecraft itself is now reusable. First time that's been done since the shuttle era. So they're going to drive the course down as time goes on. They're going to be saving the fairings. They're going to come back with parachutes and maybe reuse the fairings in the future. Everything's going to be reusable except the trunk. They call it the trunk. And that consists of, you know, the back part of the... That's attached to the Dragon with the solar arrays, they burn up. So the cost is coming way down. But still, you know, yeah, you need secondary launches. You have this relatively small, three different payloads that were in the back of the trunk of SpaceX that went up. One consists of they call it the NICA. It's a telescope that's going to be attached to the International Space Station that's going to look at pulsars and drop them. Scientists want to study, you know, these neutrons, pulsar stars. Another thing inside the trunk that the robotic arm will pull out is, I forget the name for it, but it's a new kind of solar panel that's going to open up differently than other solar panels. It's going to roll out kind of like a you know, a tape measure or you call it a polyfaber, you know, when you blow into something and it opens up, that type of thing. So it's going to be, if that works, that's going to be much more inexpensive than existing solar panels. The third thing is some kind of sextant tracker thing that's going to be looking at the pulsars. And maybe they can use it as a GPS in deep space. You know, when you go out in deep space, you don't have GPS. The pulsars, take a reading on them to find out where you are in space. So they, you know, in the back, let me drop it. They have these small, you know, could be individual satellites if you want. You know, it wouldn't take much to put one of these things on a Pegasus rocket, sign them up with a straddle launch, and launch in a couple of years, like you said. So you're ready probably two and a half years down the road, probably from now, and do that. If you have lighter loads, you can go with companies like Peter Beck's Rocket Lab down in New Zealand. He just launched the first successful rocket called the Electron rocket, and he could put up, because I just read that, you know, 300, 400, maybe 500 pounds to into Earth orbit. That's going to be his limit, and he plans on launching once a week. Yeah, Virgin Mobile, Virgin Galactic, dropping. Richard Branch, he's developing Launcher 1. Launcher 1 is going to be a similar type of rocket to a Pegasus rocket. And it's under development now. It's going to be dropped from a 747, one of the 747s that Branson owns. He owns Virgin Atlantic. So it's one of his old 747s that converted it into this plane that's going to be able to drop Pegasus-type rockets with his own development called Launcher 1. He'll be able to launch one of these every week if he wants to, theoretically. You have that. There's a company called Vector that's going to be doing the same thing with a couple of hundred-pound rockets. So you got different class rockets, you know, different class payloads, you know, a couple of hundred pounds that can go up on Vector, go up on Rocket Lab, go up on Launcher 1 on the drop. And then military payloads are going to be launched on there's another rocket under development called the XF-1 development through Boeing and DARPA. They're involved with small launch payloads for the military. They want to be able to launch like every day. So a lot of strange things coming down the road, but you got this class of 3,000, 4,000 pound things that they still need to be launched, and you'll be able to take a ride on a Pegasus rocket on Strata launch. I think that's probably the launch, you know, the theory behind it. Anything heavier than that, of course, now you got to go up on a regular full-size rocket like a Falcon 9 or an Atlas V rocket or an Ariane 5 rocket or some of the Russian rockets, Proton, Soyuz, the Paws, it goes on and on. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
I wonder if we had anybody with any further questions for Paul on the subject of space, or any questions of any subject at all. And if the answer is no, maybe we'll cut off a little early tonight. K2RIW listening for call letters. Is there any other information that you'd like to bring forward, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, I mean, there's no end, Dick, you know that. So I just want to continue on, that's fine. The Blue Moon spacecraft that Blue Origin is developing. I finally saw a picture of this thing. It's been written up for a couple of months. Never saw any pictures of it, now I finally saw a picture of it. And it's going to have the capability of landing on the moon, bringing supplies to the moon. Not necessarily people, but supplies. It's called a Blue Moon. He plans on doing this on a regular basis. If somebody, NASA or Russia or somebody, India, decides to create a base on the moon, he wants to be able to supply the base with equipment, whatever he needs. He thinks he can bring up to 10,000 pounds to the moon on a regular basis on something called the Blue Moon. But I saw pictures of it. Boy, it doesn't look too far different than the original LEM. It's got the four legs on it and everything. So, Blue Moon. Yeah, you know, he's got a lot of rockets under development. He's got the Blue Origin. He's got the name of the company is Blue Origin. Let me drop it. The guy that runs this is Jeff Bezos, billionaire from Amazon.com, probably one of the richest guys in the world. And he's got the New Shepard being developed. It's going to be taking people up into suborbital flight probably by the end of the year. And then he's got plants building in Florida. It's been under development for a year now, so probably over a year, and he's going to be building the New Glenn. New Glenn is a rocket, not quite as big as the Saturn V, but it's getting close. And then that will be the capability of even going to the moon if he wants. But not to stop there, he's developing this lander. Now this lander will be able to bring 10,000 pounds to the moon. This lander will be able to launch on his new rocket that's not flown yet, called the New Glenn. But it's going to make it capable of also launching on the Atlas V, which is launched by Lockheed Boeing, or even a Falcon 9 rocket. So that's under development. Probably in 2020 you'll see that landing on the moon. Thank you, Dick.
The ability to bring supplies to the moon in order to support a space station, a colony, or whatever on the moon, at first it sounds good. But as you've heard me say in the past, I'm rather skeptical that we're ever going to put any human beings on the surface of the moon for more than a period of a couple of days. I don't think we're going to do that in the next two or three decades, because the moon has a 28-day, a 28-Earth-day long lunar day. It's 12 days of high noon and 12 days of midnight, so to speak. And during the very long period of high noon, the temperatures on the surface of the moon get some ridiculous temperature, like plus 150 centigrade, way beyond boiling water temperature. And at nighttime, it goes down to minus 150 degrees centigrade. So that temperature extreme on the moon, it's so difficult to survive. I mean, can you build an air conditioner to survive that in the summertime at high noon? Maybe. And where is all the energy going to come from to keep you warm at nighttime at minus 150 degrees centigrade? So that huge temperature extreme on the moon is a real difficult nut to crack as far as putting human beings there and have them survive. You see what I'm worried about here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
AC2IS, query.
Okay, you want to pick up AC2IS, Dick? I have answers, but not exact answers. Rough ideas of what they want to do. Back to
you. AC2IS, we're going to pick you up in a second, Bill. That ridiculous temperature extreme. You've got that problem on the moon, and you got that problem on Mars. Mars has got numbers like minus 200 degrees centigrade at nighttime. So huge temperature problems as far as human beings are concerned. AC2IS, K2IW, you got it, Bill.
Hey, Dick, I assume that the huge temperature extremes on the moon are due to the lack of atmosphere. I'm not sure about on Mars. There is an atmosphere there, but maybe it's because the atmosphere is so thin. Assuming that the temperature is more regulated here on Earth because not only is the atmosphere, but also the water mass and the humidity in the air. But couldn't you mitigate those problems by tunneling under the surface? Would not the temperature extremes be much less in that case? AC2IS.
Yeah, the lack of atmosphere is only part of it, Bill. The fact that today you get high noon sunlight for essentially 12 solid days, and then the midnight sunlight for 12 solid days, so you get a huge temperature extreme because of the duration of the day. The moon is very close to the same distance from the sun as the Earth, so the amount of sunlight hitting the moon is very close to the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth. but Earth only has sunlight for 12 hours and darkness for 12 hours. If either of those got extended, the temperature extremes would be much more huge, even with the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is just a factor. The water vapor is just a factor. The ocean is a factor. But this huge, long day of continuous sunlight, or continuous lack of sunlight, is the biggest factor. Yes, you build a habitat. Let me drop it. You build a habitat a couple of hundred feet below the surface of the moon. The temperature there is going to be much more steady. That's the good news. How in the world do you build that habitat? You'd have to have very rugged machinery that can tolerate that temperature extreme while digging the hole to build that habitat, and all that's going to be done by remote control because you can't put human beings there during that process. So once you've got this subterranean habitat, you're in good shape. But how do you get there from here, Bill? WS2S, T2RW, this is a problem.
He's got a bell on me, I think.
Yeah, let's see what Bill, maybe Bill's got a way of doing that, and then we'll pass it over to you, Paul. AC2IS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I have noticed there's a lot of horizontal drilling nowadays related to the search for oil. So I don't know how we would manage to generate enough power on the surface, I would say, but apparently there are drilling techniques that are pretty automated, right? We're not putting people under the earth anywhere near where these drill bits are, and yet they are able to drill quite significant distances horizontally under the earth. I guess hydraulic fracturing nowadays is done, I think also the drilling is done via hydraulic pressure. I don't know how we would get any kind of hydraulic pressure on the moon or anything that's used on the water. So that may prevent those exact techniques from being used, but there are probably other drilling techniques that do not, horizontal drilling techniques that do not involve water. Just some guesses. Go ahead.
There have been some PBS programs showing you this huge drilling machine that drills a subway tunnel through the rock and sand and everything else below the surface of, say, Manhattan. And when you see these guys operating this machine and you watch the procedure, you realize that something breaks down on that machine almost every day or two, and they got to do a major manned repair of the machine to keep it operational. And so there's a lot of underground work required on the moon in order to establish this safe habitat for human beings. All of that's got to be done by remote control. You can't have human beings there during the month or two that you're doing the drilling. Or maybe it's going to take 6 months. So, Paul, there's been talk about putting a colony on the moon at the North Pole or the South Pole. There the temperature is cold but more steady. But, do you think it can be done, Paul? WS2N, K2RW?
I believe it will be done. And for a number of reasons. By the way, yeah, South Pole, Shackleton Crater, right near Shackleton Crater. That's the first one, crater that they want to really get to. They can get into that. They can get ice. There's tons of ice there. They've already proven that with their satellites investigating the moon. And it's, you know, it's quite a few craters, but that would be the one to start with. Because now you can get ice up, you know,
have to drill for the ice. And once you have ice, you have, you know, you could, electrolysis, you could have water, electrolysis, separated, you got hydrogen and oxygen, then you could have, make fuel cells out of that, you could do a lot of things with hydrogen and oxygen, with breathing oxygen, drinking the water. That will help. In the beginning, you can lay out a lot of solar panels. That will help generate some power. It can be supplemented by some RTG equipment, radioisotope thermoelectric generators. They have another type that's three times more powerful than the RTG. Just to supplement things. In the beginning, going to be hard. Now, the other thing that's going to drive, you got to drive the cost down. That's number one. What we've been doing for decades now is expensive. All the countries, Russia, us, Italy, and India, and European Space Agency. You know, you take your base, even the new rockets that are coming out. Italy developed the Vega rocket that's launched out of French Guiana. All expendable rockets. The shuttle was an attempt to bring the cost down, but it turned out to be very expensive to refurbish each shuttle mission. But now they're getting better at it. SpaceX, fourth back 11 boosters, now starting to reuse the Dragon cargo vehicle. You do this on a regular basis, and it will be, you know, right now they say it's like, if you were to fly a 747 from New York to California and throw that whole plane away, it would be very expensive to make a flight. Now you got to build a new plane to come back to New York. Let me drop it. You've got to get the... Oh, they say it's always $10,000 a pound or something to get something to orbit, and then more than that to get to the moon. You got to knock a couple of zeros off of the back of that. And the way you're going to do that is with reusability. And they're on their way to doing that. Elon Musk is doing it. Now, European Space Agency is starting to think about it with their new... Ariane 6 instead of the Ariane 5 rocket, which should go up in a couple of years. Blue Origin definitely will do it with the new Glenn that, again, plans to land on a barge similar to what SpaceX does with some of their boosters that can't make it back to Cape Canaveral. They land them on the barge. They're going to do the same thing. You got to drive the course down. Now you can bring all this equipment to the moon. And you can eventually bring people at a cheaper rate. They can stay for a week, bring them back up to orbit, and we drop it. The space station that's already planned, they plan on building a space station in lunar orbit. Let them stay there, and maybe even go back down to the surface. Until you eventually, it might take many years, develop some kind of a system. Either use the water for fuel or, you know, in the beginning it's going to be tough, just like anything else. When people came to the new world in the early days, you know, a lot of people didn't survive. It took a lot of work, a lot of time to get something going. Back to you, Dick.
Is he 2OIS?
ACQIOYS, start off with your name, sir, and then your question.
Thank you, Mark. I heard you talking about the sun on the Earth and why it's not so hot. Well, how come in Alaska, or maybe just explain something, in Alaska you have 6 months of sun and 6 months of darkness? And how come there isn't that drastic change in temperature, you know, the sun being out all the time?
You get a very low solar angle. The sun shines, you never see the sun at high noon in Alaska. It's always on the horizon. Yeah. If you go beyond the Arctic Circle, yes, you get a significant number of months of continuous sunlight, but the sunlight is right on the horizon. It's at dusk all the time, if you know what I mean. So, how much heat you get is a function of solar angle and how much time, and also things like local air and water and whatever. If you're on the equator in the moon, on the moon, the sun shines straight down on you for a ridiculous number of Earth days. And it's not heating up air, it's not heating up water, and you get some extremely high temperatures. Paul, you make it sound like, let me drop. That these problems of establishing a lunar base or a colony on the moon is being planned as such. And you keep your ear pretty close to the ground as far as what NASA and all these other space agencies are doing. Make me a guess. From what you know, how soon will we be establishing a base or a colony on the moon? Is it 10 years away? 20 years away? What's your guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
203 incoming.
Okay, this won't take long. But, well, you're Dragon plans on flying a couple of paying customers, not to the moon, you know, not on the moon, but to the moon, in orbit, bring them back by 2020. You have European Space Agency, the Director General, they call him John Warner, no relation to the rocket guy Warner. But this guy has he laid out a plan for a lunar village. This guy is from European Space Agency. He's the director. He wants to do this all the time, but it, you know, it's going to cost money. But he's got a plan, drawings. You know, figure out 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, probably for that. That's my guess. And then China has a plan on sending people. India already has satellites in orbit. They plan on sending people. They have a manned space program under development. That's probably 20 years away. And even Japan, on their own, you know, they're eyeing the moon too. They've got rovers and orbiters coming up in the next couple of years. So, of course, I mentioned Jeff Bezos before with Blue Origin. So, I don't have a good guess. I can't predict the future, but the future's coming. You live long enough, you'll see it. Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, I've got some more questions on this, but let me first go over to Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. I found some material sending about, and I was mentioning that before when we had the discussion about it. We didn't go through with reflectivity of the energy from the surface. So for the surface, with the sun directly overhead, for example, a horizontal region near the equator at lunar moon, the solar constant in the Earth neighborhood about 1400 watts per square meters minus the portion reflected, and keeping it straight, it turns out 220 degrees of Celsius, not bad. 100 Celsius is the temperature of boiling water. Let me drop. And then another scenario when the sun is not directly overhead, whether you are at the equator during lunar morning or evening near the poles, or looking at the rock face sharply angled to the horizontal surface temperature, that will be lowered because some solar energy is spread over the larger area. So now, in the ideal scenario, we have areas when we have 75 degrees of Celsius that bad at all. It's a half of the temperature, not a half, it's a three quarters of the temperature of the boiling water. And then at, the calculation of Stefan Boltzmann, but it comes to 23 degrees of Celsius, which is a typical temperature of not very warm day. And that is a certain condition. First, let me go to the temperature drop that is limited by conduction of heat from layers several meters before the surface. So let's say when the temperature goes in that particular region, and they're talking about 30 degrees north or south from equatorial temperature, you will be able to feel very much comfortable at 23 degrees, just few meters below the surface. So cave, I don't know if the natural caves on the planet moon, but or on the surface of the moon, but that could be very easy to be done with the tools that we could deliver over there. Enjoy here.
If you put a human being in a place where the temperature is 37 degrees centigrade, 37 degrees centigrade is that magic number.
Minus 24 to 20.
Seven degrees centigrade is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. You put a human being in that temperature, because his body is metabolizing food and generating 130 watts of heat, his body is going to go above that temperature. It can't go very many degrees above that without creating damage and wipe out of brain material and whatever, convulsions and so on. So a person in 37 degrees centigrade, through the surface of his skin, he has to be evaporating water to keep his body from overheating. So 37 centigrade is about the highest you want to put a human being into. And the temperature on the surface of the moon goes to numbers like 150 centigrade, way beyond boiling water temperature. Let me drop for a minute.
I said 23 degrees of Celsius to minus 23. It's typical polar.
Okay, that's the temperature that you think happened at the polar region. And there's some disadvantages of trying to establish a colony at the polar region. If you could do it near the equator, you're going to pick up other advantages, and the temperature extremes there are huge. Another thing that gives you very high temperature at high noon on the moon is the fact that the lunar soil is almost like charcoal. The pictures that you've seen make it look like a bright white material. It is not. The camera was being readjusted because there's nothing else around that was any brighter or darker, if you know what I mean. Lunar soil, when it's on a astronaut's suit, looks like black soot. It really absorbs that 1400 watts per square centimeter and gives you some ridiculously high temperatures. But if you could establish a colony on the lunar equator area or the lunar polar area, what is that colony going to do, Paul? If they're doing radio astronomy, let me drop.
It's 1400 watts per meter, not per centimeter square.
I should have said per square meter. You're right. But that's still a lot of heat. What I'm getting at is that it's going to be a huge cost to establish that colony on the moon. What do you get in return? What's the reason for doing that, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, you could go with people that believe they're going to bring back all these minerals to Earth. That's the original plan is there's some kind of hydrogen 3 on board on the moon, terrenium I think, or something. They're going to bring that back. It's supposed to be good for fusion reactors. Well, we don't have any fusion reactors yet, but it'll be good for that in the future. As far as bringing back minerals, I think they want to bring back, what's the thing in the catalytic converters? Thallium. They want to bring that back just all over the moon. I know that. I mean, that's the original thing. But now they want to use it for a gateway to Mars. And that's the next plan. Some people call it an excuse, but that's the next plan. Eventually, as a test bed before you go to Mars. So that's what I think is going to be used. It's going to be used for radio astronomy, of course. Let me drop it. And my favorite thing is so I can get a QSL card from somebody that's stationed on the moon. But it's an expensive QSL card. But I would say there's a lot of scientific things that I don't know. Like, you don't know what you're going to get until you get there. Sometimes, Dick. So, Columbus went to America. You know, they said, what are you going to do there? Bunch of Indians and no buildings, no, you know, and now we have definitely the most powerful country in the world. So it's a gateway to the stars, I'm going to say that. Sounding a little bit like Carl Sagan back in there.
Helium 3 is the target.
An ordinary hydrogen molecule has one proton and one electron. Once in a while, you get a hydrogen molecule that's also got a neutron in it. That's called deuterium. And very, very rarely, you get a hydrogen molecule that's got two neutrons. That's called tritium. And so, even if the moon had tritium, a very rare material, which would be very valuable for operating a nuclear fusion power station, if you look at the cost involved of going to the moon to mine the material and bring it back home, as opposed to sifting through seawater and finding those heavy water molecules that have deuterium and the very rare ones that have tritium, you're way ahead of the game to sift through seawater on Earth and go to the moon for getting that material. No matter what you think the moon has that's valuable, gold, platinum, palladium, tritium, deuterium, name it, uranium, polonium, whatever you think it's got, the cost of getting there to get it and bringing it back, I'm having trouble believing that that's justified, that call. WS2N, K2RAW.
Well, you have to believe that the cost of space flight is going to go down, which it will, with reusability. You know, even Elon Musk, his early predictions for a ticket to Mars once he develops the interplanetary transportation system, ITS. Once he develops this, his original plan was going to be around $500,000 for a ticket to go to Mars. Now he's got it down to $100,000 tickets because, you know, he's doing better at reusability. He's come along, he's got a better system. He's going to send up fuel rockets to refuel second stage of an ITS rocket. So, you know, he's already come down from $500,000 to $100,000. You could drive the price down, knock a couple of zeros off these things with reusability. You're going to drive the cost of getting to the moon and mining the moon and bringing it back. Will it still be will be less expensive than looking for it on Earth? I don't know. Maybe. You know, you're not going to find out until they start trying. Back here.
You coming?
Yeah, stand by there for a minute, Wes. You believe that the moon is a stepping stone to getting to Mars, and you believe that with all these guys working on ways of making it cheaper, you make it sound like you think getting to Mars eventually is going to be affordable. That's an awfully big leap. There's 1,000 times more distance to Mars than to the Moon, and it's probably 1,000 times more expensive. And to get there requires a good fraction of a year of travel time in which you're exposed to microgravity, which creates bone loss, strong radiation fields, which creates all kinds of grief to human beings. But if through all of that grief and all of that danger, you get human beings onto Mars, what is a human being going to do on Mars, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, first thing they have to do is set up a base, but the goal is to, in the beginning, we'll be looking for life. You know, that's going to continue. My guess, that's going to continue for a real long time. To think that some microbe, you know, started out here on Earth, was blasted off by a meteor and floated around the solar system for eons, and eventually wound up on Mars and survived and, you know, started life up there temporarily. That's a long shot, but they'll be looking for life on that planet for eons. Or the other way around, you think that life started there first, because it definitely was wet. We have robots up there now are riding around on Mars that have proven that. It's very wet. I think that life started there and blasted off and wound up coming here. Could be a possibility. But at least we know life did start here. So that's what they'll be doing. The next goal will be to colonize it. I mean, that's inevitable. Just like eventually you'll have a village on the Moon, you'll eventually have a village on Mars, and eventually a city, and eventually two cities, and on and on. We have to come back, though, in probably another 100 years or so. Take a look and see how we did back there.
Those first human beings on Mars are going to have to live in their little bitty shelter. They're going to get cabin fever like you wouldn't believe. The only way they can go outside is with a spacesuit, because the air is 0.7% of Earth's atmosphere. That's essentially a vacuum. It's the same kind of air pressure you've got at 100,000 feet, if you know what I mean. I don't know the exact number, maybe 200,000 feet, but it's a big altitude on Earth, which is not survivable. The only way you can do that is in a spacesuit. And it looks glamorous to see an astronaut doing an extravehicular activity on the International Space Station. But talk to somebody who has really done it. Living in a spacesuit is very uncomfortable. You don't want to do it for very long in hours. You don't want to do it for very many days during the week. And you can only do it for a brief period of time. And there's a zillion things that can go wrong with that spacesuit that become life-threatening. So a human being on Mars, with the ridiculously cold temperatures, no air, and what mobility you've got comes from a real spacesuit. I mean, the movie called The Martian made it look very glamorous. It isn't anything like that. Those first people there are going to really suffer. And getting back home is extremely expensive, extremely dangerous. And so what does a human being do there you can't do with unmanned machines? WS2N, K2RIW.
Manned machines are doing very good. Curiosity's riding around for the last 4 years, 2012, August. Have Opportunity still riding around from 2003. Here we are in 2017. That landed in January. Spirit, its partner, landed roughly 2 weeks apart from it. That thing quit working in 2006, but still ran for six years. Planned on 3 months. Got 6 years. The other one is still going. It's well over a decade. And they've got to set back a lot of science. But none of it would be possible without a manned mission, without proposed manned missions. It would be, well, possible, but not probable. society, no matter what country in, you want to be able to put a flag on a planet, on an asteroid, on a comet. You want to be able to get there, you know, have a conversation with somebody on Earth from that moon, the moon of Mars, Deimos, Phobos, Mars itself. Money drives the space program. You wouldn't have a robotic space program without a manned space program. You got Voyagers and the Pioneer spacecraft that now are New Horizons leaving the solar system. They're all robotic missions. That without a, you know, a manned, planned mission to somewhere, space station, the moon, now to Mars, you're not going to have the funding. I don't think they'll have the funding. That's what drives it. So even if the purpose is to get the money, to get the science tools, the telescopes up there, space telescopes, even that alone is worth it. So what are they going to do there? Even if they come back with nothing, they've got the money that was spent to all these different agencies to build these telescopes and find different equipment, robots riding around on different planets. That was accomplished. Even if you don't set up a colony, which I think you will, it's inevitable. Back to you.
Of all the people who have done a survey that has credibility to it, if I put all of those surveys together and try to make a best guess, you see a colony on Mars how long from now, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Inevitable means I can't predict it, but I can try, and I won't be here to see a colony. But I think I might, if I stay healthy, I might make it to see an astronaut land on that planet, either from NASA or from say a company like SpaceX. And you have a new astronaut group that's just been picked. Forget how many people have just been picked. Out of 10,000 applicants, 10,000 people applied to do this. And a dozen or so, usually about 20, I think, but I'm not sure how many, will be at NASA on June 7th with Vice President Mike Pence to talk to them. You'll be able to see that on the computer, I guess, on TV as well. But definitely on NASA TV. And my guess is one of those people, one of those astronauts, might be quite a few years from now, will be the one person that will be setting foot on Mars, or at least one of the moons. One of the moons on Mars, but I'm going to go with one of those people, probably 2039. I'll pick a number back either.
So you've read about 20 new astronauts going for training. I guess they're about to enter training. They've been selected out of 10,000. We have 20 new astronauts. I guess they're lining up for the International Space Station, among other things. Where did that appear? That wasn't in any of our local newspapers yet, was it, Paul? Go ahead.
No, I got that from the NASA site. That was an easy one. Was one of the small articles, but I did find that there. My guess is the rest of them will have it within a day or so. Space News, Space Flight Insider. One of them. But you'll see June 7th p.m. I plan on watching that if I was around to see how they do it. And if not, it'll be recorded and you'll be able to play it back usually a lot of things like that on the NASA thing you can play back. But now Mike Pence is vice president, kind of like in charge of NASA, directing it to some degree, overseeing it. That's the way it used to be for many years, and then Bush cut it out, and then now they brought it back. The vice president is kind of handling things, or helping NASA along. So that's why he's going to be there. And how many, I just took a wild guess, it might be 14 people, sometimes it's 12, 14, usually in that category, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was 20. Back to you, Dick.
In the past, the astronauts that were selected, the majority of them were very experienced military pilots. These new astronauts, do they come from a similar background from what you know, Paul? Go ahead.
Some do. Jack Fisher comes out of Littleton, Colorado, flew, I don't know how many, 40 different test vehicles. One of the first people with the Raptor. I think he flew in Desert Storm. I'm not sure, I believe so. But, you know, you got that group, and then you've got with the shuttle, all the shuttle flights, we had mission specialists. So these people were going up there with doctors. They were, maybe some of them that we flew an airplane, you know. But engineers, scientists, and that's what you have. You probably have half the people are like that. Kate Rubin just went up. You know, she was military. You have a lot of scientists that you grow up now. And it all started with Harrison Schmitt. He was the only scientist that actually ever went to the moon. Everybody else, like you said, were all military pilots and things. And, you know, Schmitt was not. And then we finally got a scientist to the moon. It was the last flight, Apollo 17, but we finally did it. But he got the ball rolling, and after that, we've had a lot of scientists going up. And you need that, of course. Let me drop it one time. When the shuttle was more trusted, you know, before Challenger exploded, and then people thought this thing was going to be going up every 2 weeks. They started in bringing everyday, they wanted to bring everyday people up. That's how the teacher in space, McCollum, got involved. She never flew a jet plane in her life, but she was going up, and she was going to teach in space. Before that, you had two politicians that went up. They wanted somebody from Congress to go up, so they needed somebody from the Senate and somebody from the House of Representatives. You know, you had those two forms of government. You know, the House, they sent up Nelson, and today, now he's a senator from Florida, but he was a House of Representatives congressman from Florida at the time. Let me drop it. They put a spacesuit on him and blasted him into space. And then Jake Gahn, from Utah. He was a senator from Utah. They put him up in space. That didn't stop him there. They sent up a prince of Saudi Arabia, I believe. One of the princes from Saudi Arabia. They put him up there. What's he doing up there? All right, yeah, the guy just knew how to fly an F, I think it was an F-18, probably an F, yeah, probably one of them, 14 or 18, but he flew a jet. But, he was the prince of, I believe, Saudi Arabia. They put him in a spacesuit, put him on the space shuttle, and put him into orbit. So it's been going on a long, long time, Dick. WS2N.
Each of these famous people that they sent up, were they sent up for a couple of days? I know that they were not up there for months. Is that true, Ripple?
Oh, no. Before the Challenger explosion, yeah, you didn't even have a space station. 1986? You didn't have the first part of a space station, International Space. Well, yeah, we had the Mir. They went up to the Mir in the 1990s. We had five five flights of shuttle flights that dock with the Mir.